missiles, that is, manned portable air defense, were useful in this conflict. I'd used our Stinger missiles in training, never in combat, and it was a damn good missile against helicopters, drones, slow-fixed wing aircrafts, and even jets sometimes. That was only if you got lucky and the jet didn't cross out of range before you got the Stinger set up and targeted. Against supersonic dropships that could climb vertically into orbit, I couldn't see a Stinger giving us any chance. I'd seen even our captured Ruha chicken gunships go from hover mode to zooming straight up at an amazing speed. Everyone I knew agreed his ground pounders needed to do something serious against the air threat, or any combat situation would be game over before we got started. The manpad missile the Kristang provided to us, we instantly named the Zinger, of course. It weighed about 30 pounds, not much different from a Stinger. The difference being the Zinger targeting system was built into the launch tube and was disposable, whereas with our Stinger, you had to attach the targeting system box to the disposable launch tube when you wanted to fire the missile. A Zinger could climb up to 80,000 feet. It was hypersonic, and if it missed one target, it could look around and decide to engage another target on its own, or the user could redirect its targeting via Z-phone, or it could talk to the other Zingers in the area to get targeting advice. Its wings could also deploy wide, so the missile could loiter in the area up to 20 minutes before its fuel was exhausted. That feature meant we could fire it ahead of time into an airspace before the enemy arrived, giving the user time to get the hell out of there. The Zinger got a genuine, enthusiastic reception when it was shown to us, and we got to use it for real against drones. Unlike practicing with Stingers, where the U.S. Army mostly had us firing little flares instead of expensive missiles, the Kristang had no problem with us expending ammunition, even though our practice rounds had the warheads disabled. It was immensely satisfying for us grunts to see drone targets knocked out of the air. Then it got tougher. The drones we fired at initially were dumb. They could maneuver a bit to avoid missiles, but had minimal defensive capability. Next, we practiced against drones that simulated Ruha aircraft and dropships like chickens, buzzards, and the nasty dropship gunship we called a Vulture. They all had laser or particle beam defensive turrets that could confuse, fry, or outright destroy a Zinger, even with the Zinger jinking on approach to avoid the beam defenses. Zingers also had to deal with electronic countermeasures, and those weren't only in the infrared or microwave spectrum. Ruha aircraft had an active stealth capability that made them difficult to see even in the visible spectrum. With active stealth engaged, the aircraft didn't become invisible. What happened was the air around them rippled, distorting their shapes, and multicolored lights blinked on and off in an envelope around the aircraft, making it hard to tell exactly where it was. The tactics we were taught to use by the Kristang was to fire multiple Zingers at a target. In practice, we could pick up a Zinger tube, unfold the targeting screen from the side of the tube, designate a target, and fire in less than a minute. One Zinger team of two people could carry and fire four Zingers, in theory, with one person operating the missile system and the other person acting as a spotter. Keep in mind, two Zingers weighed over 60 pounds, and while carrying a Zinger, you were expected to still be loaded down with a rifle, ammo, canteen, Z-phone, body armor, and anything else UNEF expected a sharp-dressed soldier to lug around with him or her. Of course, while you were setting up for a second shot, the enemy air would be looking for you and shooting back, which tended to shorten the user's life expectancy and therefore combat effectiveness. That last comment wasn't a joke I made up, by the way. It was written right into the user manual we got from our patrons, the Kristang. And they needed to work on their public relations big time. Anyway, with the Zingers, for the first time, us UNEF grunts felt we were being semi-properly equipped for the fight and that we didn't need to only hunker down in foxholes and die in combat. We could shoot back. Shoot only up to 80,000 feet, true. We couldn't do anything about ships in orbit. It gave us hope. If the Kristang trusted us with their toys and supplied us plenty, they were planning for us to do something useful in combat, wherever that would be. Most of our training time at Camp Alpha wasn't spent learning to use our new or modified weapons. It was refresher training for soldiers like me, who had been harvesting crops and helping civilians since the Ruha attacked. The work I'd done with the National Guard in Maine had been hard, back-breaking labor, but hadn't prepared me for combat. Until I got to Camp Alpha, the last time I'd fired a rifle other than hunting was in Nigeria. I was rusty and a bit out of shape. Hikes with 100-pound rucksacks, hand-to-hand combat training, and running obstacle courses toughened me up quick, and I was glad for it. The Ruha weren't going to take it easy on me. It was better to be sore and exhausted now than not prepared when we went into action. Running in heat beat the crap out of me. Running in extra gravity beat the crap out of me. Combined them, and my legs were shaken from exhaustion after only a few miles. Cornpone fell to his knees and puked his guts out 3 times on our first 5-mile run. After that, Sergeant Coke decided we'd be getting up extra early to run before it got hot. On Camp Alpha, the temperature was like an on or off switch. When the star came over the horizon in the morning, it got hot fast. At sunset, the temperature plummeted. The third morning saw us sliding out of our bunks to run in the pre-dawn cold. A day on Camp Alpha was a bit over 28 hours. Our schedule left time for 7 solid hours of rack time, even with rising early. Without the daytime heat, we only had to deal with the extra gravity, and the blowing, burnt-smelling grit, and the crushing disappointment that coming out to the stars hadn't meant we'd be transformed into super soldiers. We would become super soldiers the old-fashioned way, Sergeant Coke announced, through hard work. Those were inspiring words, until about the 2-mile mark when we were gasping for breath. Our fire team wasn't the only group up early for exercise. The second morning we were running, we were about 1 mile from the base on the return leg when we came around the side of a hill, and there was 6 people on the other side also headed back to base. Without anyone needing to say anything, we picked up our pace. And so did they. And the other group upped the ante. Soon we were sprinting. I pulled ahead. I'd been a runner since I was a little kid, and my mother brought me out running with her. The other group had 2 fast runners. Then 1. Ahead of us, the trails converged. I reached the intersection just ahead of the other runner. Then he pulled even with me, and we ran as fast as we could while our teams behind us cheered. Only he wasn't a he. He was a she. I would have known from the short ponytail bobbing behind her head if I'd been paying attention. Damn. I knew her, sort of. She was in our brigade support battalion. Her name was Shauna, or something like that. But I hadn't seen her since like 1 month before I rotated home from Nigeria. Crap, I didn't know she was so fast. She pulled ahead of me, only 1 foot. 2 feet. But I could not catch her, no matter how much effort I put into it. She was struggling, too. Her footing was wobbly, and her breathing was as ragged as my own. We shot past the 2 big boulders that marked the unofficial edge of the base, and I collapsed to my knees, having to use my hands to push myself back to my feet to walk it off. She stood next to me, hands on her knees, gasping. "Damn." "Shit, yeah," I replied. "You trying to kill me?" "Hey, you were pushing me." I held out a hand. "Joe Bishop." "Yeah, I know. You're the Barney guy, right?" "Shauna Jarrett." We shook hands. "Hey, you want my autograph?" I was only half joking. The whole Barney thing was getting really old for me. She cocked her head. "Why, does the Barney thing get you laid a lot?" A light bulb went on in my head. Yes, I know. Every time a girl smiles at a guy, he's hopeful that she's interested. But this time I thought she really might be. "Not so far," I winked. She laughed, and it was beautiful. "You keep hoping, Joe." The other people in our groups arrived, and Shauna got back slaps for winning our impromptu race. Shauna and her group started to walk away. If there was any sort of opportunity there, I wasn't going to let it get away. We were a long, long way from Earth, at war, and there weren't a whole lot of women within 1,000 light-years of Camp Alpha. "Hey, Shauna, I see you around." To my delight, she smiled at me back over her shoulder. "Maybe." Along with getting familiar with new equipment and getting back into proper condition, we had classroom time, which was us sitting on the dirt floor of a tent, listening to lectures about the enemy, our allied command structure, and most importantly, the rules. It all blew my mind when I first heard it, so I'll explain it slow. Best you get comfortable, because there will be a pop quiz at the end. I'll wait while you get yourself a beer. Comfy? Okay. First, some background intel for you. The Kristang were not at the top of the Allied coalition, which I already figured from the fact they needed to hitch an interstellar ride on a Theranan star carrier. What was news to me was that the Theranin weren't at the top either. The Allied Coalition is led by cat-like aliens called the Maxulks, rumored to be cat-like, since no human and very few Kristang had ever seen one. As humans were unlikely to ever see a Maxulks in my lifetime, all I'll say about them is they are an ancient species with incredible technology. Surely when the Maxulks fought, they were armed with something better than an M-fucking-4. And I know Maxulks is an odd name. It was the best our G2 people could think of to spell how the word sounds when the Kristang said it. The home planet of the Maxulks is two-thirds of the way around the galaxy from Earth, if that means anything to you, which it doesn't to me. It's far, far away. The Theranin, we learned, were themselves not unique. They were only responsible for a small slice of the galaxy under Maxulk's control, and the Kristang handled a couple thousand cubic light-years under Theranin control. The Maxulks had other second-tier species besides the Theranin, and the Theranin had two other species under their command that we knew of besides the Kristang. The Theranin are sort of little green men. They are shorter than the average human, but humanoid, with two legs, two arms, two eyes, and a bald head. Humans who had talked with the Kristang got the impression that the Kristang don't like their patrons, and the feeling was mutual. The Theranin were disdainful of any species with lesser technology. I wonder what they thought of us pitiful humans. On the enemy side, the situation was similar. At the top were the Rindaloo, who are creepy-looking spider-type things. Just thinking about it made my skin crawl. Their second-tier allies in this quadrant of the galaxy are the Gerapatha, who are almost as creepy, being insects. The Gerapatha aren't a hive mind like bees. They are more like beetles. The Ruhar are a client species of the Gerapatha, the same way the Kristang were clients of the Theranin. Based on some things the Kristang said, our G2 intel people speculated the Ruhar had slightly better technology than the Kristang. Kristang propaganda, I say propaganda because that's what it sounded like to me, said the Rindaloo were older, much older, than the Maxulks, and had tried to suppress the development of other intelligent species in the galaxy until the righteous Maxulks rebelled many thousands of years ago. The Allies were fighting for the right of intelligent species to develop on their own, while the enemy species were slaves of the creepy spider Rindaloo who wanted total control of the galaxy. For an advanced species, the Kristang had remarkably clumsy propaganda. Think Soviet Union, or North Korea, or Nazi Germany. We Allies are fighting the evil enemy for the glorious and virtuous common people. Under the magnificent guidance of our supreme leaders, our righteous cause will triumph. Strength through unity, and so on. Anyway, that's what we were told. I'm sure the truth is more complicated. It always is. The incredible technology of the Maxulks and the Rindaloo did not extend to creating or even operating the wormholes that made long-range interstellar flight practical. Those wormholes were created millions of years ago by a long-gone species that is unknown other than what they left behind. The Kristang called the wormhole builders the Elders. Wormholes didn't care who went through them, and there was no known way to control one or shut it off, or damage it. Even a nuke had no effect. The wormholes worked, and that's all we needed to know. Then we got to the rules. The rules were the rules of engagement for combat. They applied to both sides and were strictly enforced by the Maxulks and the Rindaloo. The rules explained why the war had been going on for many thousands of years, why both sides hadn't wiped each other out a long time ago. The basis of the rules was that the Maxulks and the Rindaloo couldn't afford to seriously fight each other directly, in the same way that America and China couldn't fight each other. On Earth, countries with megatons of nukes couldn't fight without destroying their own countries. Out in the galaxy, species with weapons that made nukes look like firecrackers also could not afford to fight each other directly. So, they fought through their client species, and those species also had clients, and so on. Most of the actual fighting and dying was done by third-tier species like the Ruhar and the Kristang, and by their clients, like humans. Anyway, here are the rules. You'd better grab a pencil and paper. Rule number one. No use of nukes or other types of radiological weapons on or near an inhabited planet or even potentially habitable planet. No antimatter either, because such a weapon produces hard radiation even if it is short-lived. This rule was listed first because the Maxalks and the Rindaloo didn't want their grubby underlings contaminating a planet they might later want for themselves. Even in the vastness of the Milky Way, the number of habitable planets within practical range of a wormhole was limited, so both sides didn't want useful planets removed from productive use because some jackass went crazy with nukes. Rule number two was no chemical weapons, for the same reason as rule number one. Nasty chemicals could linger in the environment for a long, long time. They didn't quite say that any species abandoning a planet was supposed to sweep up after themselves and take their trash with them. I figured that was implied. Rule number three, no use of nanoweapons. Nanotech was widely used to make things, but it could not be used as a weapon. Even the Kristang weren't sure of the basis for this rule, but ancient rumor held there was an incident where nanotech gets loose and caused that entire star system to be quarantined permanently. Hence, nanoweapons were a huge November gulf in the war. Rule number four, no biological weapons. This rule wasn't so much to protect the Maxalks and the Rindaloo, because species were different enough that a pathogen deadly to one species mostly had no effect on others. This rule was more like a Geneva Convention sort of thing, where the combatants agreed not to do something to the enemy so the enemy wouldn't do it to them. Otherwise, each side could simply drop stealth missiles with canisters of biological weapons into the atmosphere of enemy planets, and soon no one would be left alive on either side. Rule number four was, we heard, a little sketchy in actual use, as viruses, bacteria, and other biological hazards mutated over time, and if a known natural virus became more contagious or deadly, who could say that didn't happen naturally? Rule number four was in place to prevent catastrophic biological attacks, but apparently a certain level of cheating is allowed, as long as it didn't get out of control and no one got caught. The Kristang told us the Ruhar were notorious for pushing the limits on rule number four. I'm sure the Ruhar would say the same thing about the Kristang. The bioweapons thing scared me. Despite reassurance from the Kristang that the Ruhar didn't know enough about human biology to make a weapon effective against us. What scared me is the Kristang had medical technology far advanced beyond what humanity had brought to the stars, and they weren't sharing any of it with us. They said that without years of study in human biology, they couldn't safely apply their advanced technology to us, which meant even a common flu virus that some human brought with them from Earth could be a serious problem for the expeditionary force, and that wounded troops had to be treated with whatever medical care was available on that planet. There would be no medevac flight back to the States on this campaign. Rule number five was, simply put, no dropping rocks. No steering asteroids or comets, so they impacted an inhabitable planet. This also meant no taking even a small rock, accelerating it to relativistic speed, and slamming it into a planet. Any planet with a decent population had systems that could detect and deflect rocks that were naturally on an impact course anyway. The rule was to prevent a combatant from saturating those defenses or encasing a high-speed rock in a stealth field. What, you may ask, about railguns? Spaceships routinely used railguns to accelerate kinetic rounds up to relativistic speeds, and railguns were used for both space combat and planetary strikes. The key to using railguns for planetary bombardment was the effect on the planet. You had to limit the energy yield of a single kinetic impactor to less than a megaton, and you couldn't use so many railgun strikes that you affected the planet's climate. Pounding a planet with a lot of railguns could throw a thick dust cloud into the air and lead to rapid cooling. That dust could take a long time to settle out of the atmosphere, even leading to a mini ice age. So those were the rules. I wasn't capitalizing those words on my own. That's the way they were on UNES PowerPoint slides. The point of the rules seemed to be that inhabitable planets within practical range of a wormhole are rare and precious, and the Maxalks and Rindaloo could not allow lesser species to damage valuable real estate. The rules weren't focused on protecting soldiers or civilians on either side. There was no alien equivalent to the Geneva Conventions for space warfare. The Maxalks and Rindaloo had put the rules in place to prevent their ancient war from getting out of hand. As long as lesser species conformed to the rules, they could kill each other all they wanted. All of the rules were okay by me, especially as UNEF didn't have any nuclear, nano, biological, chemical, or relativistic railgun weapons with us at Camp Alpha. The rules meant such weapons wouldn't be used against us. Except maybe biological, if an enemy thought they could get away with it. There wasn't any point to us humans worrying about it. I didn't see Shauna running again in the mornings, and I didn't want to be creepy by pinging her via Z-phone. So I was thrilled when we ran into each other in the DFAC, which is what the Army calls a dining facility. It was a big tent with tarps on the ground to keep dirt and dust out of the food, and the pervasive acrid burnt smell to a minimum. I had a tray of sandwiches, one peanut butter, and one with some kind of mystery meat, with mashed potatoes and what was supposed to be gravy, and green beans. Real green beans, they looked like. They weren't cooked to death. And a roll, with butter. After busting my ass all day, I was hungry, and all the food looked good. I turned around to find a table and almost crashed my tray into Shauna's. "Hey, Shauna, right?" I said as nonchalantly as I could. "Hey, yourself." She looked at my tray. Her tray only had a sandwich, green beans, and an apple. "You want to grab a table?" Did I? Not trusting myself to speak without saying something stupid, I simply nodded and followed her to a table that wasn't too crowded. "You know what I was doing on Columbus Day?" I said as a way to open a conversation, only it may have come across as bragging. So I added, "Did you do anything stupid that day?"
"I was with friends in Phoenix."
"You weren't out leaf peeping that day?" She tilted her head and gave me a sarcastic look.
"People in Phoenix don't do a lot of leaf peeping."
"Got it. My family doesn't need to go looking for leaves. By Columbus Day, they're covering the lawn 2 feet deep."
"You going to eat?"
She looked at my still full plate. "Oh, yeah. Don't want to talk with my mouth full." I bit into a sandwich and swallowed quickly.
"I went home first to make sure my mother was all right. My father was on a business trip in Houston. Then I went over to check on my grandmother. She lives in a high-rise, and without power she was stuck up there. I didn't think she'd be able to make it all the way down the stairs. She's got a bad hip. And she's, you know, old."
Her voice trembled a bit. Recalling that day was bringing up a lot of emotion for her.
"She was so scared. She was so scared. And she told me not to worry about her. She told me that I was young and strong and that I needed to get out of the city, get somewhere the aliens wouldn't find me. She kept saying it was the end times, judgment day, and that I needed to leave her and survive. In the city, we didn't have Ruhar assault ships landing in the streets. All we saw were lights and contrails in the sky, and pillars of smoke from sites they'd hit. The only way we knew there was an alien invasion were emergency announcements on the radio, and I didn't believe it at first." She ate the last forkful of green beans, then pushed a tray away. "Those hamsters frightened my grandmother almost to death. I hate them for that. That's why I'm out here. I don't want my grandmother or anyone else to ever be scared like that."
"Yeah. I used to go out on clear nights, look up at the sky, and wonder what's out there in the universe. After Columbus Day, I look at the sky, and if the stars are twinkling for a second, I think maybe it's an enemy ship jumping into orbit."
"Yeah, exactly."
She slapped the table.
"Because of the hamsters, nobody can look at the sky again without fear. I hate those MFers for that."
"They stole our innocence," I mumbled over a mouthful of mashed potatoes.
"Yeah, something like that. Not you and me. We've seen combat. We saw some shit in Nigeria. But most people, just living their lives, they don't get to think they're safe again, ever."
She looked away for a moment.
"Ever. Now we know there's a whole galaxy full of enemies out there, looming over our heads all the time."
We talked about what total bullshit it was that we were expected to go into combat with basically the same gear the U.S. Army had been using for decades, and exchanged rumors about what our first deployment would be. Neither of us knew squat about where the Kristang would send us next. And we both wondered and worried about what was going on back home, while I finished my dinner and she ate an apple. Her family was much worse off than my folks. Her parents had both lost their jobs, and they, her younger brother and grandmother, had been resettled in East Texas, where her father was on a farm labor team and her mother was working at a daycare. That was a big change for her parents. Her mother had been a real estate agent, and her father a sales rep for an IT company. Both of those jobs vanished when the economy crashed, and the condo in Phoenix had become unlivable without electricity to run air conditioners. My father lost his job at the paper mill, but he got by for the first couple months on odd jobs, logging, welding, and auto repair.
My mother still had a steady job as a teacher, especially with so many families moving from electricity-starved cities to the countryside. Late in December, someone had the idea that the big paper mill where my father had worked, which had a cogeneration plant that burned basically leftover sawdust to make electricity for the mill, could be started up again to produce electricity for the region. That brought my father back to work at the mill, with the only problem being that there wasn't enough lumber being brought to the mill because there wasn't enough diesel fuel for the trucks to haul the wood. The Great North Woods had plenty of lumber and no way to get it anywhere. There was barely enough diesel fuel around for trains. The solution was to bring old steam engines from a tourist railroad in New Hampshire with guys who still knew how to keep steam engines running and how to make them run on wood rather than coal or oil. Good old American ingenuity in action, with steam engines hauling logs out of the woods to a paper mill that was now a power station. The entire U.S. electricity grid was being rebuilt slowly, as the smart grid we should have had decades ago, and lots of smaller local power stations rather than one giant plant for a whole region. The Kristang weren't helping much with rebuilding electrical generation around the planet, except in industrial areas they deemed vital to the war effort. Our new allies were disdainful that humanity still relied on fossil fuels for energy, and they set up a couple fusion reactors around the planet for their own needs. But even though they had explained their fusion technology to our scientists, it was going to be a very long time before humanity built a working fusion reactor on our own. When I left, electricity was still spotty in my hometown. Most of the power from the new power station in Milliconic went downstate to the Bangor area. My parents kept their house warm with wood stoves, didn't need air conditioning, and the garden we'd expanded over the winter should bring in plenty of crops to feed my family and the people living with them, plus food left over to sell. They had two cows now, and chickens for eggs, and when I left, my mother had been bargaining for a pair of piglets. It was the same all over the world. People higher on the economic ladder before the Ruhr attacked were now sometimes worse off than those people who had been scraping by. If you were a farmer before Columbus Day, your life hadn't changed a whole lot, other than it being difficult to get fuel for tractors, since people still needed to eat, so there was plenty of demand. What did the Bible say? Something like, many who are first will be last, and the last first? Nobody ever expected scriptural prophecies to be delivered by alien invasion. I'm busting my ass to qualify for combat duty, Shauna explained. Almost qualified when I signed up. I fell on an obstacle course and sprained my ACL with 2 weeks to go. Pissed me off. So I went into logistics. I want combat duty, Joe. Being in the infantry and having been in combat, I wanted to caution her against too much enthusiasm. It wasn't any of my business how she wanted to serve, so I kept my mouth shut. We finished eating. People from her unit came over to talk to her, and then she left. If that could be considered a first date, it was a downer. The first war game on Camp Alpha was Operation Valiant Shield. Codenames for operations were ideally supposed to be selected at random so as not to give the enemy an idea of your intent. Like, Operation Desert Storm was a cool name, but it had been pretty easy for the Iraqis to figure that op was an offensive in the desert. Not that it had mattered back then. The problem with random words is that you could end up with ops with unintentionally funny or lame names like Flaming Bunny or Limp Justice. So, really, operation names were dreamed up, or at least vetted by, the UNEFPR staff. The name Valiant Shield was probably thought to be inspiring for the troops. When I heard the name, all I could think was, we were supposed to die valiantly. Like the old Roman saying, where a soldier was supposed to come home with his shield, or on it. I wish I could tell you that during our first war game, I dreamed up some incredibly brilliant tactic that no one else had thought of, and it led us, or at least my platoon, to victory. I could tell you that. And it would be an awesome story, right? And maybe I will tell something along those lines someday to my grandchildren when they're complaining how uncool old Grandpa is. Or maybe I'll tell a story like that someday when I'm drunk, and I think it'll get me laid. And the truth, unfortunately, is that me and everyone else in two platoons of our company were declared dead from an orbital railgun strike less than an hour after the war game started. We were hustling across a shallow canyon, going from cover to cover, when my Z-phone beeped, and a squawking voice announced that I was dead. Then my Z-phone stopped working entirely. Crap. How the hell was two platoons of foot soldiers worth a railgun strike? The company had split up to avoid providing a juicy target, and that didn't work. Protocol called for us to sit or lay down where we were and wait for an all-clear signal, which would come the next day, depending how the war game was going. The sun was over the horizon, and it was getting hot already. Our officers decided we could cheat a little and walk back across the canyon to shelter under a rock overhang. That's where I spent the rest of that day, all night, and half the next morning. We were running low on water. It was a 6-hour walk back to base, because we'd been dropped off by buzzards before the start of the war game. Somebody at HQ took pity on us and sent trucks. They didn't have air conditioning, and although we grumbled about that, we appreciated not having to walk the whole way. One lesson that had gotten hammered into our heads by the war game is that the key to surviving ground combat in this war, in a situation where the high ground is above the atmosphere, is like surviving combat in situations where the enemy might use tactical nukes. Avoid concentrating your forces and keep cover as much as possible. In a potential nuclear war situation, do not give the enemy a target they might be tempted to hit with a nuke, like battalion-sized forces, large ammo dumps, fixed airfields, vital bridges, that sort of thing. The Kristang didn't use nukes against ground targets. You might think that was a good thing, however, it actually made the situation more dangerous. Deciding to use a nuke requires a whole lot of high-level leadership hand-wringing over an enormous nuclear escalation of the conflict, an escalation you can't step back from, a genie you can't put back in the bottle. Using railguns, which can accelerate rounds to a significant percentage of light speed and can have the destructive energy equivalent of a tactical nuke, it's so easy that it's a given in interstellar warfare. To us grunts on the ground, that means getting hit with a railgun from orbit is a matter more of when, not if. Overall in the war game, UNEF Blue Forces got crushed by the opposing simulated Ruha Red Force. The Kristang were reportedly very pleased with the outcome. Not pleased that UNEF troops had died by the thousands, pleased that UNEF troops had held on long enough to delay the Red Force's occupation of the surface. Scattered UNEF forces had used guerrilla tactics to attack Red Forces after they landed, and our Zinger manpad teams had shot down an encouraging number of Red dropships, and our Airedales had done well for themselves too. Sure, by the time the Kristang halted the war game, the UNEF Blue Force had less than 100 aircraft capable of flying. If you think that's bad, the Kristang had expected all our air assets to be depleted within the first 12 hours. Modern combat is high intensity, especially once your feet get off the ground. 2 days after the war game, my fire team was watching a basketball game in the evening, our battalion against a British Army team, us enjoying hot dogs and popcorn, when an Army lieutenant still wearing a flight suit sat down next to us in the bleachers. "Hey, you're a pilot, sir?" I asked stupidly. "Uh-huh," he said over a bite of hot dog. "You used to fly an Apache, now I fly a chicken." "How'd you do in the war game?" I asked eagerly. "I'd heard a lot from ground pounders, but nothing from my Airedales so far." In my enthusiasm, I didn't consider the guy might have just finished a long flight and wanted to relax and watch a ball game instead of telling me the same story he'd already told 100 times. There wasn't need to worry, because a pilot never got tired of talking about flying. "Did all right," he said while watching the game. "Shot down a dodo and a vulture." "Damn, sir. You the man." I offered him a high five, and I was thrilled when he slapped my hand. "Thanks, soldier. Of course, I got popped by a missile from a Ruha cruiser 2 minutes later. Felt good, anyway. I lived longer than I expected."
"You shot down a vulture?" Ski asked. "That's a gunship?"
"Yeah, it is." The dodo had landed troops, a formation of 6 dodos with vulture escorts. They were headed back to orbit when we attacked from 2 directions. Came in fast and low right on the deck. It was a massive dogfight, a real furball. We got all the dodos, simulated, of course, and we lost half our aircraft. That last vulture, I had to chase the stinking thing up above 70,000 feet. That's the max altitude for a chicken. We're not rated to operate out of the atmosphere. I was on internal reaction mass and was barely able to control the ship with the secondary thrusters. The vulture was way above me. It was pushing 2 G's and climbing away while I was about to lose control and go into a flat spin. I ripple-fired my last four missiles, and my gunner hit the vulture with the particle beam. The beam is defensive only, but it tied up the vulture's defenses enough for one missile to get through.
He turned back to watch the game.
Their active stealth doesn't work as well out of an atmosphere. They didn't tell us that. I figured it out.
He took another handful of popcorn out of the paper bag and ate it slowly, thoughtfully.
You know, the sky up at that altitude isn't blue, it's almost black, and you can see the planet stretched out below you is round. That Ruhar cruiser that got me? I could see it. Not as a ghost on the head-up display for the war game. This was a real ship right there, hanging in the sky. It was spooky. The image on my HUD showed a Ruhar ship superimposed over the real Kristang ship for the game. When I clicked the HUD off, I could see the real ship. A real starship, hanging in low orbit above me. It was awesome. For a moment, until it hit my starboard nacelle with the edge of a laser, I flew right through it. Put me into a spin. I was busy trying to hold the ship together when their missile crawled up my ass. Simulated, it felt real enough. I wouldn't have been able to recover either. The autopilot took over and guided me down to Angel's 30. That's, 30,000 feet.
Shit, Ski said. I thought us grunts on the ground had it tough.
You do, for sure. We're more exposed up in the sky. We have countermeasures that help a lot with missile threats. It's funny, kind of. We're almost back in World War II days before guided missiles took over air combat. The stealth and countermeasures mean getting a reliable firing solution on the enemy isn't a lock that it is in air combat on Earth. A missile only gets a hit maybe 15-20% of the time. The Kristang aren't telling us for certain. We're guessing at the 20% number based on the tactics we're taught.
He laughed.
It's funny. They sent me out here because they figured a helicopter pilot would have an easier transition to flying a chicken or a buzzard. When they're in hover mode, sure. True enough. Thing is, a chicken can go supersonic and climb higher than our jets. I wasn't ready for that. Last time I flew fixed wing was a little turboprop in training. My chicken can outclimb and outmaneuver an F-22 easy. Most of the time you're flying it, the thing is a jet, not a helo. A buzzard is more similar to a V-22 Osprey. It isn't supersonic.
He shook his head.
The techniques we learn flying rotor wings on Earth don't apply here. I have to keep reminding myself not to worry about dynamic stress on the rotor blades, and I don't need to keep the tail rotor clear when I land, because we don't have one.
Sir? Cornpone asked. We only have aircraft, right? And the enemy has drop ships that can go into space. Do we really stand a chance in combat up there?
He pointed to the sky. Oh, yeah, I get your point. Yes, we do. We actually have an advantage in air combat over drop ships. Drop ships are big and heavy. They handle like a pig when they're deep in an atmosphere. With stealth and countermeasures, if your first volley of missiles doesn't hit it, you close the distance to the target real fast, and then you're in air combat maneuvering, using your guns. The key to air combat is kinetic energy. If you bleed off too much speed in a turn, you're dead. Energy means you can engage and disengage a dogfight as you need. Dropships are ultimately much faster than our aircraft. They can reach escape velocity. But they don't accelerate as fast. We can get up to speed much quicker.
He went on for a while about tactics of air combat. The three of us were enthralled. At that moment, I thought he was the coolest guy who ever lived. I left my seat and got another hot dog for him so he'd keep talking. The game ended, though. The British team won by 2 points, and a group of pilots came by, so we left. Damn, Ski said wistfully. Wish I was a pilot. I thought about it, too. One of my uncles is in a flying club back home. The club has a single-engine, Piper, something like that. My uncle flew me and my father to Minneapolis once for a Bears game, and that was great. Never had the money for flying lessons, though.
That would be so cool, I agreed.
Yeah, cool enough. He still died in the game, Cornpone pointed out.
Uh-huh, yeah, Ski said.
So did we, and we didn't do shit before we died. I'd rather die up in the sky doing something than get vaporized in a railgun strike I didn't see coming. Inspired by watching the basketball game, Ski, Cornpone, and I went to another court and found a pickup game we could join. Ski had a really good outside shot.
I concentrated on feeding the ball to him and crashing the boards on defense. It felt good to play hard, to sweat out frustration. All of us were pissed that we died and accomplished nothing during Valiant Shield. Sure, us getting blown up from orbit was a realistic scenario. Our question was what we were supposed to learn from it. And how were the Kristang supposed to evaluate our combat capabilities if all we did was get an unlucky roll of the dice by some Kristang computer in orbit? If those imaginary dice had rolled another way, some other unlucky bastards would have died instead of us. My Z-phone on my belt vibrated during the game. I didn't check it until we took a break for water. It was a message from Shauna. She wanted to know if I was busy, and if not, did I want to get together? Did I? Did the sun rise in the east? On Earth, I mean? Hell yes. Here's a simple test to tell whether a guy wants to get together with a girl. Step one, does he have a pulse? Step two, is he conscious? There is no need for a step three. Like the idiot that I am, I typed in, is this a booty call? Smiley face with wink. Fortunately, my survival instinct caused me to erase that message before hitting send. Instead, I typed as casually as I could, sure. Playing hoops, we're winning. Be done soon. And then caught hell from Cornpone and Ski because my head was clearly no longer in the game. I kept feeling phantom incoming text vibrations from my Z-phone. We won the game anyway. Not that anyone was serious about keeping score. Damn. The game was over, and no reply from Shauna. Had I been too eager? Too casual about it? Crap. My grandmother told stories about how she had sat by the phone at her house, this before cell phones, sat by the phone waiting for a guy to call. It sounded pathetic to me back then, sitting by the phone instead of being out having fun in case some loser guy decided to call. Yet when Ski and Cornpone suggested we go see what movie was playing in the big rec center tent instead of going with them, I said I was tired and wanted to crash. They gave me a funny look but left me alone. There I was, not with my buddies, not back at our tent in case they came back there. There I was, sitting alone in the basketball arena tent waiting for a girl to contact me. For all women who've waited for a guy to call or text them back, I know how you feel. It sucks. And then my Z-phone pinged with a text. What I expected was for Shauna to suggest we meet somewhere, talk. Maybe meet her friends, that sort of thing. She totally surprised me by meeting me at a gate to the logistics group motor pool, a fenced area for the Kristang trucks we'd been using. She had the code to the gate, and we slipped in. I followed her quietly as she put a finger to her lips. We weaved our way between the closely parked trucks. I didn't know where she was leading me until we stopped behind a truck and she swung the gate back down. The truck had a canvas-type roof over it. She pulled the flap aside and pointed a flashlight inside. For a second, I was afraid there were other people in the truck, and Shauna expected me to get into some sort of sketchy activity that I was not interested in. My Army personnel file already had enough remarks about me getting into trouble. There wasn't anyone in the truck. There was a thick pile of blankets. My eyes must have shown my total surprise because Shauna grabbed my shirt and kissed me passionately.
You okay with this?
Her eyes were glittering in the dim security lights.
You're cute. Kind of dumb, maybe, but cute.
I nodded like a 4-year-old being asked if he wanted a bowl of candy.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. For those of you who've had sex, I won't bore you with sweaty details of me and Shauna. You know what it's like. And I'm sure we didn't do anything you haven't done before. Or wanted to do. For those of you who haven't, I won't spoil the surprise for you. Hint. A-W-E-S-O-M-E.
Wow.
We took a break. Some small talk. She was laying on her back, me next to her. After a while, I lightly traced my fingertips down from her neck, between her breasts and stomach, and down.
What are you doing? She giggled.
Running my fingers through your hair, I said innocently.
That's not what that means.
She laughed and slapped me playfully.
This isn't romantic?
Yeah. Like your friend here, she tapped my friend, is all about romance, Joe.
Hey, I said with my friend waking up from her touching him. He's very romantic.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, I'll bet. He's into romance. If it leads to sex. Okay, I have to admit. He is a horn dog. I can't control him sometimes.
Like right then, with Shauna continuing to encourage him.
Oh, you have no control over him? Like, you're not involved?
You have no idea. I shook my head ruefully. Sometimes I wake up at 4 a.m. because he's forgotten a key to the front door, and I'm like, where have you been? And he's like, nowhere, just out for a walk. And he smells like vodka and perfume, and I just know he's been roaming around getting into trouble.
A key? Where would he put it? He goes out by himself?
She laughed. Well, he brings the boys along. The three of them are a posse. But clearly it's not my fault the trouble they get into. My heart is pure.
Your heart is pure bullshit, Joe. But you're funny.
She laughed again.
I'm going to, talk to your friend. See what he says about this. You don't mind, do you?
No, no, please, go ahead. You can talk to him all you want. A couple hours later, Shauna said we needed to leave because there was a security patrol coming through. The security people usually only turned on the big lights for a minute to make sure nothing major was wrong. I could see their point. Who would steal a truck on this planet? What would you do with it?
I'll, call you? Tomorrow?
Damn. Should have said that before I pulled my shirt and pants back on. In my defense, it was getting chilly in the truck now that I was out of the bed.
Call me? You'll call me?
Or text you? I said slowly, wary that I'd done something wrong.
You'll call me?
Huh. She was unhappy about something.
I'd like to be mad at you, but you're so darned goofy cute.
True. It's a curse. You know, I don't want you to think I'm, you know.
What, that you're using me for sex? Joe, I'm not some silly high school girl. I'm using you for sex.
Oh.
Is that a problem?
No. No, not a problem at all, I lied. It was, maybe, a tiny bit of a problem for my ego. Yeah, I know, this would be a dream situation for most guys, unless they were completely honest with themselves about it. A guy likes to know that he meant something to a girl, even if she was a one-night stand. Yeah, it's a male ego thing, sue me.
Listen, Joe, we're on an alien planet, she said, her voice muffled by the blanket over her head as she wiggled into her pants while still nice and warm under the blanket.
I wish I'd thought of that.
We don't know where we'll be going next. You and I could be posted to different planets next friggin' week. I'm busting my ass to qualify for combat duty. I want to make a difference in this war. That's what I'm focusing on now. I don't have time for a boyfriend. You don't have time for a girlfriend. I like you. You like me. Girls get horny, and you're pretty good in the sack. No commitments. Can we keep it uncomplicated?
Oh. That brightened up my day again, now that I understood.
Sure.
Yes.
Yes. Great. She swung her legs out from the blanket, stuffed her feet into her boots, hopped to her feet, and kissed me on the cheek. I'll call you.
That kind of freaked me out. Then she did call 2 nights later, and we wore out the truck's springs. It was awesome. Any thoughts I had that my amorous nocturnal adventures had gone unnoticed went out the window at breakfast the next morning. Sergeant Coke had run us ragged over an obstacle course in the dark. I hadn't gotten enough sleep, and the three of us were ravenously hungry.
What is that?
Cornpone mumbled over a mouthful of food, pointing at Ski's bowl with a piece of toast. I looked at it, too.
Damn, Ski, I said. What are you doing?
Instead of eggs, French toast, hash browns, or anything good, he had one lonely, barely buttered piece of wheat toast and a bowl of what appeared to be plain oatmeal. Plain, as in oats soaked in water. No raisins, no brown sugar, no walnuts, not even any cream. The kind of thing you serve to horses.
Yum.
That looks like a bowl of, like, soggy sadness.
A bowl of sadness.
Cornpone choked, he laughed so hard, spitting eggs onto his plate.
That's funny. Is Soggy Sadness a Kellogg's brand?
Seriously, I added, as Ski sat there stone-faced. Eating that must be like being a Cubs fan.
Sure, once in a while the Cubs will luck their way into a win, and it's like you find a marshmallow in the bowl. But, come on, you know by the end of the season you'll be choking down a bowl of sadness.
Shut up, Ski growled.
But there was a twinkle in his eye. Cornpone slapped the table.
Bish, damn, you're killing me here.
I offered a slice of French toast to Ski, but he waved it away with a frown.
No, man. That meatloaf last night had an argument with my stomach. I need something bland after that obstacle course.
Oh, yeah, the meatloaf.
What was that gravy?
Cornpone shook his head.
10W-40 motor oil tasted like.
Nah, I think it was hydraulic fluid hamsters use on those buzzards.
Yummy.
I licked my lips. Mystery meat floating in an oily pool of hydraulic fluid.
Uh-huh.
Cornpone agreed while spooning hash browns into his mouth.
And when the oily gravy starts getting cold, it gets that rubbery skin on top, and it...
Oh! Ski's face was turning green. He pushed the oatmeal away.
Gosh, shut up, please. I'm gonna lose it.
Busting each other's balls was a key part of being in a fire team. We also knew when to quit. Last thing Cornpone and I wanted was for Ski to Ralph all over the breakfast table. And that would make us real popular in the platoon.
Not.
Here. I took two slices of wheat toast from Cornpone and put them on Ski's plate. This will fill you up. We got a busy morning. The schedule called for an hour on the rifle range. Then the platoon was hiking 12 miles, finding our way to 5 navigation points before our lunch break. This was part of our preparation for a major combined arms war game in a week, where we were hoping to show the Kristang what badass soldiers we humans were in simulated combat. Part of the war game scenario, which was still being developed, included simulated orbital bombardment and humans flying captured Ruha aircraft against Kristang dropships. UNEF would be the blue team defending the planet, and the Kristang would be the red team invaders, with the Kristang force playing the part of the Ruha. Using Ruha tactics. A couple slices of bland toast in Ski's stomach made him feel better. Enough for him to steal a piece of French toast off my plate. He was feeling better enough to ask,
Hey, Bish, that girl Shauna, you hitting that?
Yeah, Cornpone elbowed me in the ribs. What's the deal? They almost made me choke on a mouthful of hash browns.
The deal?
The deal is, first, she's a woman, not a girl.
You know what I mean?
Cornpone wasn't going to get distracted from the subject.
And? She's none of your business. We bumped into each other at dinner and we talked. It's no big deal.
You talked with a real, live, actual girl. You may have touched a real girl.
That is a big deal, Ski objected.
Cornpone. Bish, you know what? I heard that across UNEF, only 16% of the force are women. 16%! That means for every guy there's like a... For every girl there's like... 4 guys.
I think you need to check your math there, Jesse, Ski cut in.
The point, Bish, is that with those odds we're kinda desperate, and if any guy on this planet is getting laid, we at least want details.
I am not giving you details.
Aha! Cornpone slapped the table, drawing looks from others around us.
There are details.
Shit, I'd screwed that up. Guys... Hypothetically, some guy on this planet is, let's say, enjoying the company of a lady. Do you think it will improve the odds of other guys getting lucky if he talks about it? Or if he keeps his mouth shut?
Huh?
You think the women on this planet would be happy about some guy bragging about the details?
Damn it, Ski groused.
He's right.
You can brag about getting laid or you can actually get laid. It's real simple, I concluded.
Damn.
Hell, in that case... Cornpone said grumpily and reached out with his fork. I'm taking the rest of your French toast.
My Z-phone beeped one morning while I was on the rifle range. It was a message from my platoon ordering me to report to a Captain Andrews on the other side of the base. Andrews commanded a company in another battalion of our brigade. The message didn't say on the double. That was implied. When I found the tent Andrews was using as company HQ, I stepped inside and saluted.
Specialist Bishop reporting as ordered, sir.
Bishop, he barely looked up from his laptop.
At ease. I'm sure you know we left Earth without a full complement. If people couldn't get to Ecuador by the departure date, they got left behind.
I nodded.
Transportation to Ecuador had ironically been more difficult than transport up to orbit and across the stars. Because of manpower shortages, we had sergeants in charge of squads, staff sergeants filling in for first sergeants, lieutenants acting as captains, etc. The other fire team in my own squad had only 3 soldiers, and the battalion had scraped together new squads from understrength units. Overall, the 10th Division had 14% less manpower than authorized, and that didn't even count the field artillery battalions that had been deliberately left behind, or most of the sustainment brigade that had also been left behind, so we didn't have our combat engineers with us. It was a big problem that division was still sorting out.
I got your personnel file here, Andrews continued, and my face fell.
I'd seen my personnel file, the original one on paper, still an official army triplicate. Coming out of Nigeria, it said bad attitude on it, all capital letters, and it's underlined twice. There isn't even a smiley face as the dot over the I in attitude, so you know it's serious.
I hope Captain Andrews wasn't going to underline it again and circle it with a big angry face.
Running frantically through my memory, I couldn't think of anything I'd screwed up more than usual since we left Earth. Balanced against my alleged bad attitude was a purple heart that explained the scars on my left arm, and paperwork started to award a Bronze Star. That paperwork had stopped at the brigade level, which I could understand considering the circumstances. I appreciated the gesture anyway.
"You know Staff Sergeant Agnelli?" he asked,
and I nodded again. Then he said something unexpected.
"There's an opening for a sergeant in his squad, and you've been recommended."
He didn't say who had recommended me.
"It's yours if you want it. We don't have time or resources for a regular training program, so you'll learn on the job. If you're interested, report to Agnelli, and I'll handle the paperwork."
Shit. I didn't know if I was ready to command a fire team. 3 guys I didn't know. Andrews cleared his throat.
"That was me waiting for an answer, Bishop. I know this is unusual. We don't have time for the normal process out here."
"Oh, yes, sir. Thank you. I mean, yes, I'm honored. Yes." Promotions was supposed to be a more formal process. I was taken completely by surprise. The division had holes that needed to be filled.
"Uh-huh." He sounded less than convinced. "Agnelli will keep you out of trouble." "And Bishop?"
"Yes."
"Stay away from ice cream trucks."
He wasn't smiling. Taking command of a new fire team wasn't the most difficult part of my promotion. My 3 guys all had experience in Nigeria and knew what to do without me needing to tell them much. Staff Sergeant Agnelli was patient with me, and other than the administrative part of the job that was overwhelming at first, I didn't have much trouble adjusting. The Army didn't have time to put me through the standard training, which saved me from memorizing a bunch of crap, and I'm sure that would have come back to bite me in the ass later. The most difficult part of being promoted was leaving my old unit. Sergeant Coke, Ski, and especially Cornpone. Cornpone had a tear in his eye, which he said was caused by blowing sand, and my eyes teared up too.
"Damn," Cornpone said. "Think how much stupid stuff you get into when I'm around. What are you going to do without me? And the Army put you in charge of a fire team?"
He shook his head sadly.
"If I see an ice cream truck, I'll run the other way."
He snorted.
"Bish, that takes care of like 10% of the problem. You get into a situation, you should think, what would Jesse do? And then do the opposite?"
I laughed. He made an exaggerated shrug, then gave me a back-pounding hug.
"Take care of yourself. Don't forget to write."
I pulled out my Z-phone.
"Write? With this thing, I can see your ugly face whenever I want."
"Ah, damn." He rolled his eyes. "I forgot about that." He pulled out his Z-phone. "How do I block people from calling?" The Kristang didn't have faster-than-light communication, but the U.S. Army rumor mill did.
"Sergeant Bishop?"
Shauna was the first person to call me about my promotion.
"Man, they'll promote anybody."
"True enough."
"Seriously, good for you, Bish."
"Confession?
I have no idea what I'm doing." "Bish, we'll be fighting aliens. Nobody knows how to do this. We'll make it up as we go."
Damn, it was good hearing from her. Which reminded me, I needed to review the Army regs about fraternization. Shauna wasn't under my command. She was in a different battalion. Did that mean I was okay to continue being with her?
I sure hoped so.
My new squad was led by Staff Sergeant Salvatore Agnelli, who despite the name had blonde hair and looked more German than Italian. In my fire team, I luck